Welcome back to The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeological artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last episode, we followed the tide of rising anti-Jewish brutality, both in Crusader-run Europe and Muslim Spain and North Africa. And we met Maimonides, one of the most famous Jewish scholars in history, whose work reshaped Jewish thought for all who came after him. This week, we will follow our story forward into the 12th and 13th centuries, with a focus on Europe. Amidst all of the turmoil and warfare occurring across the Middle East and Europe, Jewish society was also evolving, and a communal structure was crystallizing that would come to be known as the kehillah, or community in Hebrew. This organizational structure initially developed in Northern Europe in the early 12th century, and later spread outward to encompass almost the entire Jewish diaspora. The kehillah's purpose was to make the Jewish communities of Europe as self-reliant as possible, since it was becoming less and less safe to rely on their Christian and Muslim neighbors. The kehillah's structure was somewhat hierarchical, with a president and a sort of board of directors, each with a unique role, under which operated a series of committees, each responsible for a different function in Jewish life. As any organization does, the kehillah required some money in the bank with which to operate. This money came from both taxes taken from the Jewish community, as well as funding from a group of wealthy property owners called the Tuvei Ha'ir, or good people of the city. Given that it was their money that was being utilized, the Tuvei Ha'ir had the privilege of nominating the community president, called the Parnas. The Parnas, who was usually a man, was responsible for overseeing all of the operations of the kehillah, and for appointing a community rabbi. The rabbi, who acted as both a religious and legal authority, assembled his own Jewish court, called a Beit Din, which would hear religious questions and rule on them. Alongside the rabbi was the gabai, who functioned both as a tax collector and a sort of community policeman, who would arrest people who had been summoned to stand trial before the Beit Din, and would even dole out corporal punishment when it was ordered. The taxes collected by the gabai were used to provide a variety of services to the community, with each service being provided by a different committee, called a chevra. Although the leaders of the kehillah were almost exclusively men, there was broad female participation on the various chevrot. Examples of these chevrot included the chevra kedisha, or burial society, which was composed of the most well-respected, usually elder members of society, and was responsible for looking after and burying the Jewish dead. The chevra shas, which provided Jewish education and promoted literacy to the Jewish youth. The Bikur Cholim, which ensured that all Jews in the community had access to healthcare, and the Tomchei Shabbat, which functioned as a Shabbos food bank. Interestingly, many of these committees will still be familiar to many Jews today, since many diaspora Jewish communities and synagogues are still organized around this kehillah structure. Synagogues still have both presidents and rabbis, and modern-day gabayim, instead of roughing up members of the community, carry the Torah during prayer services. Jewish communities today still have numerous chevrot as well, most notably the chevra kedisha, which is still seen as the most sacred of mitzvot. But in the 12th and 13th centuries, there remain significant differences between Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jewish practice, depending on the dominant culture or religion that surrounded each community. Specifically, the Ashkenazim were largely surrounded by Christians, while the Sephardim remained surrounded by Muslims. One notable difference between the two communities was the role women played in Jewish life and ritual practice. In Ashkenaz, women tended to play a very active role in Jewish society. In shul, where sermons and prayers were chanted in Judeo-German, an early form of Yiddish, male and female congregants were divided during prayer by a screen called a mechitza, meant to minimize sexual thoughts during prayer. However, at least until the late 13th century, it was not uncommon for women to be allowed to stand on the bima, wear tzitzit and tefillin, and read Torah. In fact, in the city of Worms in the early 13th century, one synagogue had a female cantor. Women also played a large role in Brit Milah, or ritual circumcision. In contrast to current tradition, 12th century Ashkenazi mothers would themselves carry their child out to the circumcision bed, and would themselves act as the sandek, holding the child as the ceremony was performed. It was not until the late 13th or early 14th century when rabbinic objections arose to this kind of female participation in Jewish ritual, most notably by rabbis Meir of Rothenburg, Samson ben Sadok, and Yekutiel bar Moshe. These rabbinic objections largely stemmed from fears that women and men mixing during religious ceremonies might provoke sexual thoughts among the men, a fear rooted in deep-seated sexism and influenced by contemporary Christian thought. Although not as literate as their male counterparts, a large number of 12th-century Ashkenazi Jewish women could read and write in Hebrew, with literacy rates much higher than non-Jewish women of the time, thanks to standardized early Jewish education for both boys and girls. Ashkenazi women were also fairly independent, especially compared to their Sephardic counterparts. They were not mandated to wear veils, they could appear in court to plead their own cases, could own property, and, even though it was technically forbidden by the rabbis, many Ashkenazi women employed Gentile maidservants or took their children to Christian wet nurses. Even rabbinic Jewish law itself was, at least in some ways, becoming more egalitarian. A number of rabbinic rulings, particularly by the notable Rabbeinu Gershom, expanded women's rights when it came to marriage and divorce. Back then, most marriages were a result of matchmaking undertaken by Jewish parents, and the matchmaking started shockingly young. Particularly in more wealthy Ashkenazi families, children were sometimes betrothed at 12 or 13 years old, with girls sometimes married off even younger. However, although the rabbis suggested that children respect these parent-made matches and give them a fair shake, there was agreement that children could not be legally forced into an incompatible marriage, nor forced to stay in an unhappy one. The result of this was that divorce was not only legal, but actually occurred fairly frequently. Acceptable reasons for divorce were fairly broad and included poor sexual chemistry. However, both man and woman had to agree to a divorce for it to move forward. Within a marriage, there were a large number of rabbinic laws around sexual intimacy, which actually left men and women on fairly equal footing. Women were legally protected from spousal abuse and were given full right to refuse any sexual advances by their husbands. And, in fact, men and women were equally obligated to please one another in bed. Sex was encouraged to be pleasurable and to happen often, especially on the eve of Shabbat. And sexual taboos seemed to be fairly limited, aside from a prohibition on spilling semen outside of the body, which was viewed to be a waste of God's gift of life. The only other major sexual prohibition involved avoiding sex during a woman's menstrual period, after which she was obligated to bathe in the ritual bath, or mikveh, prior to re-engaging in sexual relations with her husband. All of these rules seemed to be aimed at maximizing Jewish fertility, and thus continuing to grow the Jewish population. Another big rabbinic ruling from the Ashkenazic rabbis was a ban on polygamy, which seems to have been an active practice in the Sephardic Jewish world, particularly for traveling salesmen who would not infrequently take second wives. When it came to jobs, Jews held a variety of occupations in the medieval world. Ashkenazi women mostly worked as midwives, healers, and marriage brokers. The men would commonly work as gold and silversmiths, gem traders, wine sellers, doctors, apothecaries, cooks, and interestingly, as crossbowmen. This last one became common due to a prohibition by the Pope against Christians using crossbows against one another, in a further attempt to maintain Christian unity. But of course, no king was willing to go unprotected, so many rulers hired and trained Jews as their new vanguard of royal protection. Perhaps the most common profession of Jews in medieval Europe, among both men and women, was as moneylenders. What made Jews so attractive as moneylenders had to do with the religious and social situation of the time. As a subjugated population, the amount of interest that Jews were allowed to charge on financial loans was strictly regulated by their local rulers. This was in contrast to other cultural groups, such as the Lombards, who also offered moneylending services, but charged much higher interest rates. Because of their history of persecution and exile, the Jews had also by this time created widespread trade networks all across Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, giving them unique access to land and other natural resources. Furthermore, the crown exerted a massive amount of power over the Jewish lenders, since they were the Jews' main source of protection against the ever more anti-Semitic Christian church. The result of this dependence was that when a Jewish lender died, a third of their property would revert back to the crown. And if the crown was strapped for cash, they could simply jack up tax rates for the Jews, force immediate loan repayments, and use other cruel tactics in order to balance their books. If the Jew was unable to comply with these spur-of-the-moment requests, they would be shipped off to jail immediately. This system put immense pressure on Jewish moneylenders, making their existence at once lucrative and highly precarious. The crown's hold over Jewish lenders was so complete that in most years, money stolen from Jews made up 1/7 of the English crown's yearly revenue. One of the most famous moneylenders in 12th century Ashkenaz was Aaron of Lincoln, a man who made it big as a financier and had funded a number of massive building projects for the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Bishop of Lincoln, and even King Henry II himself. By the time of his death in 1186 CE, Aaron was the wealthiest man in all of England. But Aaron was still a Jew, and upon his death, his entire estate was seized by the crown, the majority of it being shipped to France, where King Henry was at war. The rest of the cash was tied up in loans Aaron had made to as many as 450 debtors. This created such a complicated financial web that King Henry established a whole new state department, the Sacrarium Aaronis, just to sort it out, a project which took 5 years. Fifteen years after Aaron of Lincoln's death, a new pope was appointed, who would go on to significantly increase the power of the papacy in medieval Europe, and who would make major changes to Christian doctrine that would have significant ramifications for the Jews of Europe. Prior to the 13th century, there was a constant back-and-forth power struggle between the pope and the European kings, a messy division with the pope largely governing Christian practice, and the kings in charge of civil society, politics, and war. However, in 1198, a new pope was appointed who would change the pope's role in society forever, Innocent III. Innocent was born on the outskirts of Rome, studied Christian religion and law at university, and quickly rose through the ranks of the church to become pope in 1198. At the time of his accession, the Holy Roman Empire and the church were in crisis. Emperor Henry VI had just died, leaving the empire temporarily leaderless. There were smaller power struggles going on in Italy and Germany between men vying for rule. The Kingdom of Jerusalem was still controlled by Saladin's Muslim forces, and the power of the papacy was fading. Pope Innocent III was determined to re-establish the power of the papacy and to retake Jerusalem for the church. In his first 2 years of being pope, he made some massive changes that greatly consolidated his power, such that by the end of his second year, not only was the pope the most powerful man in Christendom, but had practically taken political control of much of Italy. As the years went on, Pope Innocent consolidated his power further, ultimately gaining political control of all of England due to the weakness of its ruler, King John. Pope Innocent essentially made it so that the pope had authority to intervene in civil law, supersede the rulings of kings, and dole out justice and punishment as he saw fit. And, as one of his last acts as pope, Innocent convened the largest meeting of bishops in Christian history, the Fourth Lateran Council, in 1215 CE. The Fourth Lateran Council had several main objectives. The first was to launch a new crusade, not just to take back Jerusalem, but to beat down anyone who did not accept the Christian faith. The second was to further increase the church's power in the legal system, allowing them to try accused heretics in papal court, as opposed to civil court. Third, the council made some significant changes to the beliefs and rules of Christianity. Most notably, the council decreed that all Christians must attend confession and take communion at least once a year. And it formalized the idea of transubstantiation, which was the belief that, when communion was taken, the wafer and wine physically became the body and blood of Jesus. More dangerously, in its attempt to crack down on heretics, the council also introduced even more anti-Jewish decrees meant to physically distinguish Jews from the rest of Christian society. A mandate was introduced that Jews must wear a badge shaped like the Ten Commandments, as well as a characteristic hat called a Judenhut, which is depicted in many pieces of art at the time. The Pope also sanctioned a campaign of aggressive conversion in an attempt to speed up the second coming of Jesus. Lastly, Innocent introduced a ban against what he called immoderate usury, essentially warning royalty off of gouging citizens for taxes. This ban actually made some European kings nervous enough to ban Jewish money lending altogether, fearing that the advantage they had been taking of the Jews might be considered by the Pope to be immoderate. However, despite the ban, Jews continued to work as moneylenders throughout much of Europe. The rise of Pope Innocent III and the Fourth Lateran Council marked a turning point when it came to Jew hatred in Europe. Prior to the turn of the 13th century, anti-Jewish racism, though still vicious and violent, had a sort of warped logic to it. It was either based in xenophobia, such as in ancient Egypt, fundamental misunderstandings about Jewish lifeways, such as in the early Roman Empire, or as a means of carving out a niche for the growing religion of Christianity, as in the latter half of the first millennium. But beginning with the Crusades and supercharged after the Fourth Lateran Council, anti-Jewish racism took on a whole new level of viciousness, violence, and absurdity. Jews began to be viewed not only as heretics, but as literal demons, spawn of the devil himself. They were viewed as subhuman, and as such, their physical characteristics began to be warped and morphed in the minds of Christians. Beginning in the 13th century, medieval art begins to feature Jews with warped features, such as hooked noses, black hair, and bulbous lips. They were always depicted wearing the mandatory badge and Judenhut, and were sometimes even depicted as the Judensau, kneeling, suckling from the teat or anus of a pig. Judensaus can be seen even today, carved into cathedrals throughout Belgium, Switzerland, France, and Germany. Along with their subhuman appearance, Jews were thought to despise non-Jews so much that they were willing to do despicable things to them. I should reiterate here that all of these accusations were demonstrably false and were simply lies propagated by the church and spread throughout Christian society. One of the most common charges levied against medieval Jews we have already heard about, the charge of ritual killings of Christian boys. Although the first of these accusations occurred in England in mid-12th century, the rumor spread like wildfire in the 13th to 15th centuries, leading to the murder of thousands of Jews across Europe. As time went on, layers were added to this vile myth, particularly the accusation which appeared around this time of the blood libel, that Jews would collect the blood of their victims and consume it in various forms, including baking it into their Passover matzah. The blood libel myth was completely ludicrous, especially since consumption of any sort of blood is forbidden in Judaism. And so, various outrageous explanations evolved to give credence to it. One explanation had it that Jews had a perpetual stench that could only be removed by bathing in Christian blood. Another had it that Christian blood acted as an aphrodisiac for the Jews. But perhaps the most common explanation traced back to a legend about Judas, the disciple who was said to have betrayed Jesus. The story was that on Good Friday, Judas, in remorse for his betrayal, hanged himself from a fig tree, and as he died, his intestines burst forth from his anus along with some blood. Because of this, Jews were thought to have inherited a propensity for hemorrhoids, which would bleed every Easter time. In fact, the rude gesture of giving someone the middle finger, which was previously a Roman hand gesture representing the circumcised penis, eventually came to symbolize the finger that a Jew would use to plug up his anal hemorrhoids and prevent bleeding, and subsequently became a rude gesture to represent Jews in general. I don't think I have to tell you how horrific these rumors were and how much violence and death they led to. The myth of the blood libel became so dangerous for Jews, in fact, that the famous Rabbi Moshe Isserles, called the Rama, advised Jews who lived in densely Christian areas to drink white wine instead of red on Passover, for fear that the red wine might be mistaken for blood by Christian neighbors. Another anti-Jewish myth that took hold of Christendom after the Fourth Lateran Council was the myth of host desecration. This rumor had it that Jews across Europe would try to steal the Eucharist wafer from churches and physically torture it, stabbing it with knives or grinding it to dust, as a means of torturing the body of Jesus. Because of the declaration of transubstantiation in the Fourth Lateran Council, this act would have been viewed as deicide, a crime punishable by death, and led to the murder of thousands of Jews throughout Christian Europe, particularly in Germany, the Rhineland, and Italy. One quote by the leader of one of these murder sprees, a Dominican preacher named Giordano de Rivalto, says, quote, "All the Jews were killed so that it was impossible to find one in all of the province. It was a blessed thing that we could kill them," unquote. This rumor, just like the blood libel, makes no sense at all, because Jews did not believe that Jesus was divine, nor did they believe in transubstantiation, making the Eucharist wafer completely meaningless to them. Interestingly, as the Renaissance occurred in the late 16th and 17th centuries, and religion faded in societal importance, the myth of host desecration died out almost completely. A few decades after the Fourth Lateran Council, despite its ban on usury, a Jew named David from the English city of Oxford became the next big thing in moneylending. David lived in the 13th century, the same time period in which the blood libel allegations were taking off, the Third and Fourth Crusades were raging, and three successive kings ruled who had a habit of demanding extraordinarily high taxes from their subjects: King Richard, King John, and the young boy King Henry III. If you're at all familiar with the story of Robin Hood, you'll know that during this time, the crown was really putting the squeeze on their subjects, levying outrageous taxes and having local sheriffs rough up anyone who couldn't pay. This economic crisis extended to Jewish moneylenders as well, and the crown bled David almost completely dry. As he geared up for the Crusades, King Richard frequently canceled the debts that prominent lords owed to David, slashing his income. Each time this would happen, David had to struggle to rebuild his fortune, finding new clients to shore up his business. But finally, after 30 of these loan wipeouts, David was in danger of losing everything. And so he took a new strategy, going into partnership with other Jewish moneylenders to spread out the risk, sort of like a cooperative. But as I mentioned before, men were not the only ones involved in moneylending. Numerous Jewish women were highly successful financiers as well, including a recently widowed woman named Licorisha, whose husband had been a moneylender as well before his untimely death. During her working life, Licorisha had become incredibly wealthy, and also quite worldly and well-connected. According to Jewish writings, Licorisha frequently traveled to various Jewish communities, riding in a horse-drawn carriage with armed escorts and wearing incredible gowns of blue silk or blood-red fabric with rabbit fur trim. She could read, write, banter, and argue with the toughest barons and bishops, and regularly had tea or business meetings with high lords and noblemen. In 1242 CE, Licorisha and David of Oxford crossed paths, and David was instantly entranced. He and his wife, Muriel, had been struggling to conceive a child, and after meeting Licorisha, David could not get the woman out of his mind. So, after confessing his love for her, he promptly divorced his wife, without even having the courtesy to tell her to her face. When Muriel received word of David's intent to divorce her, she was rightly pissed off and decided to take him to court, since modern Jewish law forbade a husband from divorcing his wife without her consent. She hired her brother as her lawyer, who submitted the case to a group of French rabbis. The rabbis ruled in Muriel's favor, as did the Beit Din of Oxford, who officially nullified the divorce. But David was not going down easy. He and Licorisha used their political connections to appeal directly to the Archbishop of York, who quashed the Beit Din opinion, and even procured a letter from the king himself sanctioning the divorce. David died just 2 years later, just after Licorisha gave birth to his son, Asher, but his estate continued to provide for Muriel until her own death, years later. This story illustrates the unusual way in which legal cases sometimes unfolded in medieval Europe, with conflicting opinions from religious and civil courts. But Licorisha's story did not end with her new husband's death. As the crown worked on resolving David's estate, fearing that Licorisha might hide or steal some of the assets, they arrested both her and her newborn son, and locked them in the Tower of London for months, until the estate was resolved. With Licorisha behind bars, King Henry III absolutely demolished the estate, confiscating David's library of books, many of his nicest belongings, and even his house, which he converted into a royal dormitory for new Christian converts. By the time all was settled, the crown had confiscated nearly 5,000 marks, enough money to build dozens of warships, and used it to rebuild Westminster Abbey. Upon her release from prison, Licorisha continued her work as a moneylender and built a reputation for being pretty ruthless in collecting her debts. She officially retired in the early 1270s, and in the spring of 1277, was found on the floor of her home, mysteriously murdered. As King Henry III grew up, he continued to institute even more costly and unpopular policies across England. The king's reckless policies and his refusal to take any advice from his council of barons eventually sparked a civil war between king and council in 1264, a conflict called the Second Baronial War. In one of the war's most dramatic moments, King Henry was actually captured by Baron Simon de Montfort, the leader of the revolt, who subsequently took control of England for himself. The baronial wars left the Jews in an even more tenuous position, since de Montfort had relied heavily on Jewish moneylenders to help finance the revolt, and was now balking at the prospect of having to repay them. Ultimately, in 1272, de Montfort was defeated by King Henry's son, Edward I, who ended up taking the throne. King Edward inherited an England from his father that was essentially bankrupt and owed a significant amount of debt, and so Edward set his sights upon drumming up as much cash as he could to help finance the ongoing crusade. He decided to target the kingdom's Jews, many of whom the crown actually owed money to. In order to both punish the Jews and revive England's economy, Edward forced Jews to wear a special badge, limited the towns in which they could live, and banned Jewish moneylenders from charging any interest at all. In 1275, a rumor spread that the Jews of London had been shaving bits of silver and gold off of English currency, and Edward had almost every Jew in London arrested, imprisoned, and hanged. Finally, in 1290, the king made his big move and formally expelled all Jews from England. They were given 4 months to get out, and were only allowed to leave with whatever possessions they could carry on their backs. All of their property and valuables were left behind, and all debts owed to them were cancelled, conveniently including significant debts owed by the crown itself. As the Jews fled, the English Christians looted Jewish homes, picking over any belongings they had been forced to leave behind. Just 16 years later, the Jews of France were also expelled, for similar reasons. Within less than 20 years, the two major European kingdoms were purged of their Jews. But this would not be the last of the ethnic cleansing of European Jews, as we will see next episode. That's where we'll leave off for this week, with the Jews of England and France exiled, and rapidly rising anti-Jewish violence across the diaspora. Next week, we will turn our attention to the rest of the world, and see what was happening in Spain, France, and on the Asian continent in the 13th and 14th centuries. That's all coming up on the Jewish Story.